Hello, welcome to Series 5, Episode 9 of the Prompted by Nature podcast. I hope you're doing well. So firstly, before we get onto the episode, is our action point for this week. And you'll have to excuse me, but this one is more relevant to UK listeners. I know I've got listeners all over the world. This one's more relevant to the UK folk. So I found out about this app a few weeks ago called When to Plug In. It's been produced by the National Grid. They haven't asked me to say this, by the way. But it's really useful because it gives you a map of the UK and where the energy is the cleanest and at what times. So for example, if you're charging your phone or if you have an electric car or you have any appliances that you want to charge up, you go onto this app and it will tell you the next window of time. Usually it's they're kind of 2-hour slots when you can plug in to charge things, and they'll be powered by renewables like wind or water or solar, as opposed to fossil fuels. It's quite useful, quite fun to look at. The maps, like Scotland is always zero in terms of the carbon load. So yeah, it's quite interesting if you're trying to do your bit and want to kind of geek out a little bit. So I've put the link to the website and in the show notes, and you can just find it on whatever app store you use. So on to today's episode. Today we'll hear from one of my teachers, the wonderful Catherine Alto. Catherine Alto is an American teacher, designer, speaker, and New York Times best-selling writer of creative nonfiction. For the past 25 years, her creative practice has fused nature and culture, teaching the literature of nature and place, designing beautiful and sustainable gardens, and writing about the natural world. Based in England, she teaches popular online and live writing courses, mentors emerging writers, and leads writing retreats in England and in the United States. Catherine is the author of 3 books, including Writing Wild, Women Poets, Ramblers, and Mavericks Who Shape How We See the Natural World, The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh, A Walk Through the Forest That Inspired the 100-Acre Wood, and Nature and Human Intervention. Her personal essays and book reviews appear in the Smithsonian Magazine, Outside, Sierra, BuzzFeed, Resurgence and the Ecologist, and many more. In this episode, we discuss Catherine's childhood and youth growing up in Southern California, how her love of the personal essay came about and how this influenced her writing, her connection to nature and place and how this has changed and developed through her life, her definition of sense of place, how her perception as an expat enriches her understanding and encounters with nature and landscape. And actually, I found her thoughts on this really interesting because she talked about how wonderful it was to come to England and have this network of footpaths. And I think, you know, I've talked before about Benfield Valley Project and the kind of land access work that I do. And it was really interesting hearing someone speak about that from a kind of external perspective, because I think I get so engrossed in it. I think about actually the good things that we have in terms of footpaths and stuff like that. You know, there's a lot of issues there, but it was really lovely to just kind of step back a bit and go, actually, it's really lovely hearing a much more positive view of things from someone who's come from a different country. We also speak about the impact that public speaking has had on her writing, which, again, I found really interesting, and I think you will too. She talks about some of her writing tips and what it means to show, not tell, and all of the other things. I took Catherine's nature writing course last summer, and I absolutely loved it. In fact, I think I mentioned it in a couple of episodes with some of my guests. I'm not often able to invest in myself or my ongoing learning, so it really was amazing to finally take a writing class. I think I'm so used to teaching that it was really joyful to be a student again, and I can highly recommend any of Catherine's classes or workshops. She's such a skilled teacher. She really knows what she's talking about, and she walks the talk, you know. You can find Catherine and all of the information about her forthcoming writing courses at www.catherinealto.com, and that's K-A-T-H-R-Y-N-A-A-L-T-O. And she's also over on social media at Catherine Alto on Instagram and Twitter. I've also added Catherine's books to my bookshop over on bookshop.org. So please do pop over there and have a little browse. As always, you can find me over on my website, www.promptedbynature.co.uk, and on social media at prompted.by.nature on Instagram, at promptedxnature on Twitter, and promptedbynature on Facebook. I have a few local in-person courses and day retreats coming up, which I'm really looking forward to. So do have a look on my website events page if you're local to Brighton and Hove. The writing prompt that follows this episode will be up on Tuesday. I hope you really enjoy this conversation. Happy listening, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye.
My name is Catherine Alto. I'm an American writer, designer, historian, teacher, and occasionally public speaker living in Exeter, England.
And one of my teachers, which I'm always very pleased to say.
And you're one of my star pupils.
So first of all, thank you for saying yes, because I know you're really busy and you've kind of been on my list for quite a while, especially since having done your course. I just thought, you know, I just thought you'd be such a wonderful guest to have on. But I would really love to go. We can kind of talk about what you're doing now in a bit, but I would love to hear about your creative journey, your journey as a writer, whether you've always been a writer, when you started to kind of refer to yourself as a writer, which is something I'm thinking about quite a lot at the moment. But yeah, I would love you to start us off by just talking a bit about how this all came to be.
Sure. So I grew up in what's called the breadbasket of the world, which is the Central Valley in California, which is this, I don't know, it's maybe 400 miles long and maybe 150 miles wide or something like that. So it's midway between San Francisco and the mountains. So it was a great place. Everyone says it's a great place to grow up. You know, you could ride your bike from San Francisco to Yosemite National Park in one day, through the farmland of the Central Valley. So my father was a garden designer and an ag teacher. So he taught high school agriculture. He taught people how to be farmers. If you go further back, my family is, you know, they're Austrian immigrants and Irish and British immigrants, and everyone sort of coalesced eventually in the Central Valley on both sides, and French, I suppose, from a long time ago. But the French side's been in America for a long time. So I grew up with a father who had who was a really talented a designer. And the joke is, you know, I got my dad's green thumb and his green eyes. And so the girls in the family got my dad's green eyes and the boys got my mom's brown eyes. And so I grew up with somebody who was really practical and loved designing. And so I, you know, on the weekends, I would help my dad lay bricks and, you know, help build a hot tub and garden and learn how to garden. And I loved saying the word ornamental horticulture. He loved ornamental horticulture, you know. So that's where it started, at least the gardening side. But I was always really interested in, I can't remember a time I was not thinking about like people's relationships to the natural world. So, you know, when you envision the Central Valley, if you don't know where it's what it looks like, it might sound like, oh, it's full of, you know, a green valley, and it's so beautiful with streams running through. Actually, it's big ag there, big corporate agriculture. And so if you look down over it, as you know, fly over, it's a continuous right angle grids. Everything has been divided up. And so I was curious, like, how do other people live in the world? And you know, in different in China and South America, is this can't be the only way to live. And it's got the highest rates of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma there because of pesticides. I grew up in an almond orchard, walnuts and so forth, but I felt like it's very gridded and very managed. But you know, the Sierras had Yosemite, and then the San Francisco had, you know, the ocean. I grew up loving being in my father's Garden of Eden, But when I went to university, I went to UC Berkeley for English. One of the first things I did was I read an essay by John Muir, who walked from basically San Francisco to Yosemite. And in that very first essay, I think it was written in 1863, it was about his journey on foot and through the Central Valley. And I thought, he's describing a place I don't even recognize. He described woodlands and chaparral and meadows and grizzlies. And, you know, nothing like that existed. So I became really interested in natural history. And I became interested in essays, not textbooks on natural history, but essays. And essays written with the naturalist walking on by foot. Because I really like to hear their how the place was passing through them. And that really, that was kind of the spark there. So the first thing is, you know, questioning where I was from, you know, really becoming interested in natural and environmental history, and becoming enthralled by the essay. So it can be an essay about food or memoir or whatever, but I am bonkers about the essay as a form. So that's how my place has shaped me. There are other things too. Did you ask me also about writing itself, Helen?
Yeah, and I was just thinking actually as you were speaking kind of on that, in terms of the writing, when did that fascination with the essay and with how place moves through a person or a person moves through place, how did that become something that you started writing about, or how did that how did your writing come from that?
Yeah, you know, I think about that every now and then. So when I was about 9 years old, I had a wonderful teacher. She was my neighbor, named Mrs. Blixt, and she had this hair that looked like a vanilla ice cream cone. So she sort of swirled it upwards. I would always spend time looking at her hair. But every Friday, she had a descriptive writing class. So 9 year old me pulled an image out of a basket, and we were supposed to write descriptively about it. And the very first time I wrote descriptively, I had to search for the right words for feelings and sensations and colors. And I loved it. So when I was 9 years old, descriptive writing was the thing. I loved pairing words and feelings and phrases with something I was looking at. So for me, and this comes to why I'm a designer as well, because I am quite visual, but quite wordy too. I like words to capture what I'm looking at and feeling. I'm not a mathematician and I'm not an engineer. I am a specific kind of, my brain works in a certain way. So that's when it started. So I always knew I loved that. So I always have words going through my heads and phrases, and I'm always looking and trying to capture things, words, in my head. And then when I was about 13, I had about 13 pen pals from around the world. I used to watch a show called The Big Blue Marble, and you could write to the television shows on Saturday mornings, and they would pair you with someone. And so I became an absolute prolific letter writer to people all around the world, kids my age. And so, you know, I love also putting pen to paper. I still do. Behind me is I have a Victorian letter case where you can open it up and you can see, you know, stamps, lots of stamps and pens and calligraphy and paper and that kind of thing. So I happen to like the texture of writing. And then around the same time, my older brother quit his paper route. He was only doing it because my father told him to do it. And he was saving up money for the Boy Scout Jamboree in Washington, D.C. But as soon as he went, he quit. And I'm like waiting in the wings for it. So I became, it's a joke, it's Katie the Paperboy. You know, Katie the Paperboy is here collecting money, Mom, people would say when I would go to their houses to collect money. But I started a paper route when I was, well, about 12. And I didn't stop for 6 years. So I delivered newspapers every day before 6:30 for 6 years. And I love, you know, the written word that way too. And I ended up winning a trip to England and Scotland when I was 17, and lots of scholarships and this kind of thing through the newspaper back in the day when kids were the, you know, the way people got their news. We'd throw it to their the front porch. And so anyway, I won this trip, and I wrote about going to England and Scotland. The features editor asked me to write something, so I did. And then a publisher of a local newspaper read the article, and he said, I'd love for you to be an intern. So I was an intern at that newspaper for a summer, thinking I was going to be a journalist. And I ended up back at the Modesto Bee, which is the newspaper I was delivering as an editorial assistant. And then from there, I became slightly disinterested in journalism and more interested in journalistic techniques that you could use in the essay. So I wanted more of the artistic part of the essay, which is, you know, there's a literary craft to the essay, as you well know, having been in one of my classes. And, you know, you can be present in the narrative, you know, the sensations and the beliefs and feelings. That's important. And what you're hearing is about that time when I went to Berkeley, I became very interested in creative nonfiction or narrative nonfiction. And that's when we use fictional devices to make our nonfiction come alive. So that's that. So it came from, you know, being a young kid fascinated by descriptive writing, letter writing, journalism, the personal essay, and then sort of morphing into someone who now writes full time and teaches. Somehow I do both. Yeah.
Somehow I do. I wonder how you do both, because it just both are quite all consuming, I think.
They are.
But I was just thinking about it's interesting what you say about, you know, when you were nine, that's when you were, you know, obsessed with the descriptive writing. Like, my daughter's eight, she's about to be nine, and she's at that point now where she's kind of encountering the world in that way, where she's always trying to, she does a lot of drawing. She does writing as well, but she does a lot of drawing. And I feel like there's something around that age where things just sort of start to come alive in a way that perhaps they haven't before.
Yeah. Yeah. I can relate. I am doing everything that I loved to do when I was a kid, which is writing and drawing and teaching. So I used to play school, at school. And, it's funny. I feel that I'm, there were five of us kids in the family, and there was sort of benign neglect, you know? And we were always encouraged to lots of freedom to ride our bikes. We grew up in a small town. You know, pursuing your, there was nothing else I would have done except become, you know, I might've become a book designer. I loved designing documents, you know, potentially a book designer, or at one point I wanted to be a political cartoonist, because I like to draw. But really I'm really inspired by beauty. I like to, as a garden historian, I like to create landscapes. And as a garden designer, I like to create landscapes that, you know, are obviously sustainable, but also beautiful. And when I design gardens, I'm also writing. I'm creating a narrative, basically. So I interview the clients, for example, and I ask them, you know, what I'm trying to do is, you know, from taking the nature writing, that we, you know, we think about characters in terms of the background, and we think about, you know, motivations and so forth. So a garden to me is a story, and the characters could be the plants. But often it's the client, and what do they want? You know, do they want a restorative place? Do they, what do they want? I tend to be doing less of that these days because I'm so busy sort of writing and teaching right now. But that's, I'm always thinking about gardens, and I do write for Timber Press, which is, you know, a big, publisher of books on botany and gardens and design and natural history. So that's who I write for at this point.
And just thinking about that kind of connection to nature aspect of it, has that changed as you've got older? You sort of talked about, you know, seeing where you grew up as like the very gridded landscape, which I also see in the UK as well. I live near the South Downs and people think it's lush, and but actually a lot of it is just gridded landscape. You know, there are the wilder parts, but as you've kind of grown and got older, has the way that you encounter nature changed at all or adapted or?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I think, well, for 15 years, my partner and I lived on a farm. We bought a little fixer-upper in Washington State. After we met at university, we moved up to Washington State for grad school. And we bought a little farm, and we restored a salmon spawning stream there, and we had nesting bald eagles. And I really, you know, beautiful dark chocolate valley soil to grow things in. You know, I immediately became like feeling like I was a caretaker of the place. I was passing through the place, but a very, 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 very deep connection was made with the place. So much so that it was almost broke me when I moved here, when I had to move here to England. And we've talked about this, Helen, in my nature writing class. We've talked about that idea of sense of place. And I'll just define it for your listeners as how I defined it when I was in grad school. It's that invisible layer of memories and history and emotions that cover a physical landscape with this invisible strata. And so I really developed, you know, I had a sense of how the valley was formed. I had a, you know, it's not just human centered, it's how rivers shape the place. And we had a lot of second growth maples and gorgeous untouched black cottonwood trees. And we knew what Native Americans had lived there before us. And it was old to us. It was like built in 1920. It was like a, you know, a farmer's cottage, which is like nothing compared to England. So, you know, and my first son was born at home. So I felt a really, really strong sense of place. So, you know, he's a professor here at the University of Exeter. So we needed to move so he'd get this tenured position. And I was raising our kids at the time. Well, I still am, but they were little. They were about 3, 6, and 9 when we moved here. And I thought I landed on planet Mars when I got here. I'm like, what is going on in this country? Like, Devon, like, what is this, Teletubby land? And I was discombobulated by everything, like accent, architecture, what people wore, television, pubs. But on our second day in living here, I walked into a bookstore and I picked up a book on walking public footpaths. And the next day we were out walking. Because I knew from my definition of sense of place that I needed to speed things up and I needed to get to know England. I needed to lay down memories and I needed to get out. We moved here basically September 1st, 2007. Here it is 15 years later, finally got my British passport about 3 weeks ago, but I'm a dual citizen. But so I knew that needed to happen. And what happened is I felt absolutely in love with England because there's an ancient network of public footpaths that you can walk here that we just do not have in the United States. You know, I'm from the American West where it's car culture and it is barbed wire and gun culture and private property. You know, so people talk about where I'm from in California, like, oh, you're from California. And they think of, you know, Southern California and they think of Hollywood. And it's like, you know, you live there and yeah, the ocean's great. This, you know, the weather can be good. Now it's of course changing with climate change. So it was a revelation just to walk here. And it was like, I combined with my love of the essay, you know, that came, you know, decades earlier about this walking and sensing the world that way. That's kind of the big deal is that I walk a lot. We've walked as a family a lot too, in ways that we just don't in the US. Like in the US, you need to have a car and you need to, you know, it's a trek. You're going on a hike. You could just ramble here. I could walk to you from my outside, I could walk to you, Helen, from here I am in Devon, all the way across southern England. If I wanted, I could use public footpaths. I could walk to the Hebrides, basically, almost. And that to me is like a natural rhythm of being human that is miss that's been missing for so that is a big part of what I write now. The books that I've written and the essays that I write are almost always about me on a walk. And that is kind of a trope that I use. I'm super comfortable with it. And I like to feel like my readers are kind of friends and we're on a walk together, you know? So it's perfect, not only for what I like to do with my body moving through the world, but also what I like to do on the page, you know, with readers.
Do you know what I find so interesting about what you just said is I think because of the stuff that I do, like, you know, in the background and access to land and stuff like that, you saying about, you know, oh, we have this amazing network of footpaths and all of this sort of stuff that they don't have in the States. And because at the moment, you know, the land access is a real issue here because we have so little, you know, we don't really have that vast expanse of green space necessarily, especially in England, I think. And you know, there's a lot about like trespass and how, you know, you can be on somebody's land and not even realize, and how, you know, people are kept out of the countryside and stuff. And I was just thinking about, and you said how it's such a car culture in California. And it's funny, you know, the perception that, well, I have, we can have, I don't know, from the outside, because I always think of like, you know, America is so vast and everybody's out walking. It's probably just like the echo chamber that I'm in. And there's the Pacific Crest Trail, and there's all these amazing like national parks and things like that. And, you know, I, you know, I walk a lot, I run a lot when I can. And running for me has always been how I explore a place and how I encounter a place. It's like, I don't know where I am, so I'm just going to go for a run, get lost, and then figure out where I am.
Love that.
But it's really interesting hearing you say it from that perspective of coming over here as someone that's come from the States and seeing it from that kind of more objective perspective. Yeah, it's not something I necessarily consider.
Yeah. Well, the book, was it The Book of Trespass or Trespass that came out last year, or the year before, I can't remember. That book is really interesting to me because I have exactly what you're talking about, which is an outsider's perspective, which is I think it's now I only look at sort of the paths that I'm walking on. I don't consider what's around me. Like I don't know what you know, you know, and you know what you know. You don't know you know. It's so there's I'm aware that I also highly edit my perspective as an expat. I have a highly edited and almost fairy tale kind of perspective on living here because I moved here when George Bush was president, and soon thereafter Obama was elected. That's how long I've lived here. I couldn't deal with two political systems at the same time. And I decided that in my mind, I could make England whatever I wanted. I could make England whatever I wanted it to be. And I have that right. It's my life. I don't care. And so I read the New York Times every morning, what I want to read, but I've highly edited what I put into my mind and body and spirit these days. And so England to me is a little island off the coast of Maine, and it has lots of lovely footpaths. I don't read, it's terrible. I don't read the newspapers here. I edit it out. I don't, because England to me fits in the bottom half of my own home state of California. It's a very small place. At the same time, it's really big because I can walk here. So to me, it seems vaster in many ways than the American West, which is you're scared to walk there. I remember the first time I took my kids, it was in Sherbourne, and we walked through a field, a farmer's field. And there were sheep. And we got to the other side and it said, you know, please close the latch. And there was a little handwritten sign for pub, like this way. And I thought, I was so nervous about like a rancher with a gun who was gonna like shoot me or something like that. Honestly, I was like, you do not walk on other people's land in the United States. So the ruckus here about trespassing is it's valid to people who live here, but to me, it's a great, there's a great sense of freedom. But I also don't allow my mind to entertain other things like, you know, I don't think about the class system here. I don't. I think about the landscape. That's what I think about here. That's it. And I think about gardens and I think about pretty things, you know. And then I go back home to the States quite a bit. And then I'm in a whole different system. But I defined early on, I ascertained early on that I could define my own reality, which is a gift as an expat. And when you move and you've lost everything, I lost my farm, my wonderful set of friends in Seattle, my family, my extended family on the West Coast, community. I was really involved in my community, my job, my nation, my identity. And then you lose sort of everything. And you're like, you know what? Actually, you can stop feeling sorry for yourself. And you can actually say, I can edit. I can edit what I want my life to be.
I was just listening to you speak and I was thinking actually, and even, you know, talking about the differences between the land in the States and here, for me, it's actually a really nice, maybe not reminder, but like acknowledgement for me of like, yeah, we have these footpaths. We don't, on the whole, have to worry about guns. You know, I know, you know, there are areas where you do, but I'm talking about if we go into somebody's land, on the whole, we don't have to worry about it. It's not like, yeah, I think I can completely understand that. Because I've never been an expat, I don't know what it's like to move from one, put leave one identity behind and move into another almost.
Yeah, it's really, really hard. It's really hard. It even, you know, we're speaking English together, you know, but it you know, so that even d despite the fact that, you know, this is where English was created and born, there's so many differences. And initially, I don't sense the, you know, I can pass through places where I remember being a new expat, and I still went sort of cringe a little bit at how it makes me feel. Like I remember how lonely and displaced I felt, and how far I've come. Like I feel very, very at home. And I've gotten to the point where I go to like you know, Dorset or Somerset, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm in a foreign country, you know? And I'm like, I want to run back to Devon now. I've become quite provincial. And Cornwall's, you know, it's just kind of funny the way, but you know, time works its way through all things, doesn't it? And I also knew that time would, and I didn't know that I would want to live. I'm really happy here, and I would love to live the rest of my life in England. That's how much I love it. The problem is we have three kids who live in the United States. Like, so I have about 10 years or so before grandkids start showing up. So, I'm just going to enjoy it. And you know,
That's all you can do. And did your, because obviously you've been writing that whole time and just generally being creative. Did your creative practice or your writing practice, did that change or was there anything that happened that was perhaps different when you moved here? Did, you know, how did moving here or just the way that you encountered the landscape, how did that all change when you moved here in terms of the way that you write, how you write?
Well, I always saw myself as a writer. I always knew. It's a funny little thing. When I was about tw 10, 11, 12, I remember thinking, you're gonna, I didn't think, oh, you're gonna become a famous writer. I didn't think that. But I knew that I was gonna write. Like I had A inside me as an author. You know, it turns out my surname is AALTO. So whatever. But like I had author. That is my identity. And so there's never like any question, like, would eyes, like, well, how, when, you know? And so what happened is, so we bought our farm in the US, we had children, we got our graduate degrees, I got some years of teaching in, which was really important because that's what I love to do. And then when I moved here, I had to slightly retrain again. I got a degree in garden design from the London College of Garden Design, went to Bristol, got another master's in garden history. Because so I was trying to bridge the two because I was focused on writing for Timber Press. I always knew I was going to write for Timber Press. So by having not teaching anymore, I was forced to do, to step into who I always knew I was going to be, what, who I was. So I didn't have, the farm was very time consuming. And so to have everything cleared away and then to just have everything set up. So I became a Timber Press author because of moving here. And so my, so before then I had written, as I mentioned to you, articles for magazines and newspapers, ended up writing a collection of lyrical essays for a designer in England called Luciano Jubilee. And that bit of writing became my sample writing for Timber Press. And so I wrote a book proposal for Timber Press. And they were like, well, we don't really do that now. Now they do with it, those kinds of ideas. I should revisit them. But they said, let's, we see you as an author for us. I'm like, darn right. Like, I'm like, everything like lined up, you know, it got garden designer, garden historian, naturalist, like, let's find her a book topic. So I started to dream. And one thing that happened when we moved here, the kids were really little. You know, we were reading a lot to them and walking a lot when we were here. And so we were reading like the Winnie the Pooh stories. And my littlest said, Mom, is there a 100-acre wood and can we walk there? I'm like, you're asking the right person. So one thing led to another. And the book, The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh, A Walk Through the Forest That Inspired the 100-acre wood was born. And it became a, as you know, a New York Times bestseller. And it was a People Magazine best new book pick. And it was on National Public Radio, which is like the BBC. There was a feature on it. And it went all around the world. I still get letters from people who are reading it. That book launched me into public speaking, because I have a little bit of a, I'm quite comfortable speaking and a little bit of a theater background. And if you're an author who really likes to do that, then as I do, I love to travel. I like to connect with people. I like to tell stories. Then that was a great thing. And then I wrote another book for them called Writing Wild: Women, Poets, Ramblers, and Mavericks Who Shape How We See the Natural World. But what happened is, you're talking about creative process. It was during all of that public speaking, when I'm standing in front of crowds between 50 to 500 people in Harvard bookstore all the way up to Cornell Botanic Garden to, you know, auditoriums full of people. And that was when I, in it almost became narrative performance. And, you know, in narrative nonfiction, we're creating scenes and we're crafting scenes and conveying information. It's this lovely dance between the two. And the best writers do it kind of seamlessly and lyrically, and you still hear their voice. And probably my best teacher as a writer was becoming a public speaker, because I was crafting scenes as I was talking. And then I'd get better and better and better at that. And unlike writing a book, where you don't hear from anybody, you write a book, takes a year to write a book. It comes out a year later, 2 years after you read it, you get reviewed, you know, people write you letters, it gets reviewed in magazines. Then you finally get feedback on what you wrote, which is great, but it's like delayed, you know, and I'm already off on another book topic. But when you're public speaking, you get immediate feedback on your writing. You could feel people cry. And you know, my aim was always to make the, you know, the middle-aged man who's been dragged in by his wife to one of my talks, make him cry. And so, or laughter, you know, but whatever it is. So you can feel the effect of your writing, like a murmuration of starlings kind of go through a crowd of live people. So that was the biggest on it. I have a couple master's degrees. I know, lots of wonderful authors as friends, but the biggest teacher for me has been public speaking as a writer and feeling the immediate impact of what obviously I've written it before and I've practiced it. So it comes across as just public speaking, just talking, but that has been the biggest teacher. And so now when I write, I think about how is it going to make like a live audience kind of feel and sense and that kind of thing. So I have a kind of a tempo when I write and cause I don't want to talk too much about information. I want to entertain and educate and help people feel like they're with me, So there's a lot to public speaking, and how it's helped me.
And I feel like Writing Wild, which is a book that I love and I recommend to everybody. And the way that you teach, you can really feel that, like as a student, as a reader, I think you can really feel that. And also I think it's quite an important, because one of the words that you taught me was painterly. I'd never heard that word before I took the course. And I think the idea of, like you said, you want people to feel like they're on a walk with you when you're writing. And I think that's such an important, the idea of making people feel something is so important, because it's you being as immersed in what you're writing as we are in reading it, if that makes sense.
Yes. Well, you want to kind of dissolve that barrier between time and space in writing, and that's what happens, is that when you can craft really good scenes, you can, in two paragraphs, you can move people hundreds of years, and you can place people, you can just move things around. And we take it for granted, except, as you know, in classes, I teach people to read like writers and not just read passively like, readers. I mean, that's what you do. I do it initially, like when I read your papers, Helen, I would, read enjoyably at first, and then I go back and read like a teacher and like a writer. Okay, well, can we move things around? So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to bring people into particular moments, and it takes a while, to teach people the difference between showing versus telling. And showing is what puts people, readers, into a scene. It makes them feel like they're right there with you. And you want to do that with, all this from taking a course with me, but, your presence on the page, narrative presence, when you're in it, you feel like, oh, the author's a friend of mine or a character, and I care about them. Then there's, dialogue and monologue that puts people right, like you feel like you're a fly on the wall when you have really good dialogue. An internal monologue, you feel like you're somehow in the writer's mind, which is this amazing, think about it, like an amazing thing that we can do. And then, characterization, you want to think about how you're putting people on the page, and again, sense of place, as we've talked about. And then this whole attention to language and voice, language creates the voice, but voice is so important in memoir. And so there's a million micro decisions we make as writers to create something seemingly simple. I think I told you this quote, but Hemingway once said, easy writing makes hard reading. And if you think about it, if it's easy to write, he also said, yeah, writing's easy. All you do is sit at a typewriter and bleed. It's really important to think about it as a craft, and to think about the kind of impact you want. And yeah.
Something you said just made me think about narrative voice. Has yours changed as you've kind of become more experienced in as a writer?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Yeah, I would say that there's a difference between the natural world of Winnie the Pooh and Writing Wild. And what you're seeing is that those couple years of public speaking, and just feeling like with the 100 Acre Wood book, I felt quite, there are all these Winnie the Pooh fans around the world, rabid Winnie the Pooh fans too. And I'm like, I'm a Wind in the Willows fan. Yes, I like the bear, but I'm more of a, so I had to, I was quite self-conscious about writing about this beloved iconic bear, and about A.A. Milne and E.H. Shepherd, arguably the most beloved books in the children's books in the English language. So I felt like, and I got approval from the estates of A.A. Milne and the estates of E.H. Shepherd to write this book. And I felt like, God, they trust me. Okay. And I was a little more self-conscious as a writer then. And then after all of the sort of acclaim for the book and where it went and the doors that it opened, I quite relaxed into Writing Wild. So Writing Wild is my natural voice. I'm quite proud of that book, just because it was me talking with other girlfriends. I was like, well, who's going to read this book? Actually, I think I may have told you in class, but I wrote the book with two people in mind, kind of like my dad, because he was a farmer, but kind of no nonsense. And I was a women's studies minor. I studied it in addition to English at Berkeley. If I could not explain advanced feminist theory to my dad, who could not care about advanced feminist theory, then I had to start over. He was a real salt of the earth, no nonsense. And so I never want to like exclude anybody from my writing. I'm quite democratic and quite community conscious. I want everyone to feel invited. I want everyone to feel like they can learn something. There's a heck of a lot of research that went into the book. Dozens of pages of research, citations, so many citations. But I don't like to make my research show. I like to have my own voice. So, I can write academically, but you don't reach wide audiences in an academic voice. You just don't, because it's a quite exclusive kind of language. And, in academia, it's all about, can you make your very educated reader who's got, an MBA and two doctorates, can you confuse them, and we don't want to do that. I have no interest in syntactical wordplay and showing off how convoluted my sentences can be. No interest. I want it to be understood, and I want it to be democratic and accessible and honest and fun. Things have changed between those two books, and I look forward to where it's going to change even more, especially after these last couple years of intensively teaching and being a real and. So I used to teach university level students, and now I teach people such as yourself who want to know how to write and come because usually people are between 25 and 65 in my classes, more women than men, and there's a real real interest in everything from writing for blogs to personal journaling to personal essays to narrative nonfiction. And I've been doing this long enough that people are now getting published that I've worked with, that I've helped get published, through mentoring and all the courses that I teach. So we'll see how my next book changes as a result of that. It's going to be an interesting discovery.
Getting published and writing, winning awards, I believe, recently. Did one of your students win an award recently?
Yes, in fact, she did. That would be Nicola Pitchford won the 10,000-pound prize for the Nature Chronicles Prize. And I discovered that it was the first essay I read, and it was only by the third page to the end that I recognized that it was her. And I told the committee, I said, I recognize, I mean, it was without a name, it's all anonymous. I said, I know who this is. And I'd never read that essay before, but it turned out that essay was in the top three of everybody, all the judges. And I tried to talk everyone out, myself out of it, but everyone loved it. So I just said, yay. Yeah. So Nicola was, she's going to be a speaker in my personal essay class too. I'm so excited about all the speakers I have in my classes. I have to say, there's so many of them that are I'm so honored. One of them is Nicola. And she's very modest and very humble. And she's actually president of a university in California. She never tells anybody, but she is. And so, yeah, so I think she's especially proud to have won this award. Yeah.
What did, just thinking about your courses, when did you start, teaching online? When did that sort of become something that you moved into?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about it before the pandemic because I knew people were doing things online. You could record things. And then what happened is, so you may know that I founded the Rural Writing Institute with a writer, James Rebanks. He's written The Shepherd's Life and English Pastoral. And he said, well, we have to cancel RWI this year. I said, yeah. And he said, you know, I've been doing lots of Zooming. We should do something with Zoom. And one thing led to another, and he said, well, we need to let's do something to help people feel like they've got company. So he and I sort of created the Friendly Little Writing School online. And so we created interviews, a writing. We created a 3 to 6, I can't remember how many classes. And people around the world signed up for it. We thought, wow, this is interesting. And then I said, let's do another one. Let's do a winter writers series. We brought in Pulitzer Prize winning. He picked three, I picked three. It's like this, like here we were, two people, you know, an American expat in Devon chatting with my friend James Rebakes, a male northern farmer writer. It from there, it was really clear that people wanted courses. So I created something I had taught at the university level before, really short courses, really short, just to during the pandemic help people. And then it became apparent that I needed to help everyone from the beginner to the advanced writer. And you've seen me grow with the courses, you know. So I still do beginner, which I like the personal essay and nature writing. And then there's narrative nonfiction one that I do, but then people are like, now we want more. So I'm like, okay, we'll do memoir two, narrative nonfiction two. What else? I've got everything's out ready to go for a start in February. And now I'm doing advanced projects. You know, people have taken five courses with me, and they're ready. They are, you know, serious people who've got great ideas. And I think what I love, I you know I, how much I love it. I think what I love the most is I like the fact that a community is created, and people become friends, and everyone teaches each other in a way. You know, I lecture at first, and then I slowly decenter myself through the 2.5 hours of class. So I lecture, and then we do writing exercises. We take a break, and then I lead a discussion, and then and then I break people, the bigger classes get broken up into discussion groups, and then we take another break, you know, and then people are doing writing workshops where I teach people how to critique each other's work, and they learn from what people are doing well in their own essays, and they can identify when they're not doing so well themselves, and you know, there's that positive accountability in the class too. So, you know, I never have to tell people to do their work. People just do their work because they want to, and they want to grow innately. They want to grow as writers. So I bring into the classes, you know, that love of language and that love of story. And you know, a lot of people come to me through my books, you know, and then my website. And so I have a lot of people who are interested in the natural world, you know, gardens, nature writing. But not everyone. You know, it's probably 50-50 about this point, you know, strong nature cohort, and then the other 50% is who knows, you know. Yeah, but it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I
I'm
love
never
it.
going to stop. I absolutely love it. I love it.
That definitely comes across. I think the best thing, because you know, I was a teacher for a long time, still do some teaching, and I think that's the thing that comes across in a teacher the best is when they absolutely love what they do.
Yeah.
And I'm conscious of time, but what I was going to say was, even though I had years and years of critiquing other people's work in terms of like teenagers, it's a completely different thing critiquing a peer, you know, someone who is there for the same reason that you are. And yeah, you're not marking their work, you're giving them feedback and it's constructive, but it was almost like I developed that skill as well, which I perhaps hadn't done so much of as a secondary English teacher, which I found really interesting.
That is really interesting. I haven't heard that feedback before because I'm on the outside listening to make sure that people are, you know, on time. And I'm kind of like, you know, I don't butt in or anything. Except to say, I think people are being, I think you're all being too polite. Now, Lobo, you have a couple of critical things to say, you know, and some people in the class are like, I don't want to hear the good things. Just tell me what I need to do right. Or
It's change. True.
No, it's great because I can, you know, I'm going to, you know, I travel too. And wherever I am, as long, you know, make sure I'm at a place with Wi-Fi. Like I went to Rome in the spring and, I had a couple of courses to teach while I was there. I just was, you know, popped into my hotel room and taught them. So I worked and then I popped back out and I was walking around along, you know, along Roman ruins. So for me, it gives me freedom, but also I couldn't have imagined having people from, California, like right now, my nature writing class or my narrative nonfiction class is three people from the West Coast, someone from the Midwest, East Coast, you know, throughout England. And in our class, we had someone from India, people from Germany and France. It was inconceivable before that I could have all of these interesting people in one learning space. Like, why would I want to get on a train, get dressed, get on a train, go to a class of existential 18-year-olds who don't want to be there, to pull teeth to write a paper? Forget it. Like, So I'm in my dream job, and I love it. I absolutely love it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love that. So just before we wrap up, last two questions, which I tend to ask everybody. So is there one lesson that you've learned on your journey or your path that you'd like to pass on to others?
Right. So to answer your question, Helen, which is a really good and thought-provoking one, I think everyone should think on that like I am currently thinking on it. I would say one of the best things to do is understand that sort of time heals all, I won't say wounds, but giving things time is really important. So not only just in life in general and, you know, lessons from being an expat and, you know, having lots of friends who were young die. I had a lot of young friends die between about 28 and 35, you know, and learning to live with grief and all of that. But I would say just in terms of the writing process, that get up and get away from your writing. That if you are sitting and trying to figure something out, the best way to solve it is to go for a walk or to go to sleep and to not force it. I think we all have our different creative processes. But I also think that that art is part of the, you know, part of leading a holistic, happy life, and a reflective practice as an artist is really important. And so I would say maybe some advice that I could, practical advice I might be able to pass on is, having a writing space of your own. It's not just about writing. It's about it's meditation too, for me. It's meditation. It's about collecting yourself. You know, I write, one of your questions was about writing. I do write every day. I am surrounded by way too many journals right now. I am so embarrassed, but I do have one that I'm always writing in one. One is mind, body, spirit. Another is course creation. Another is sort of books and they have different purposes. But I would say that, you know, going back to that idea of time, you know, making sure that you have time set aside to cultivate that part of your life. It's really important. When I don't write, my day is like, it feels like a day without exercise or a day without proper food. So to me, collecting my thoughts, whether it's personal journaling or writing properly under a book contract or an essay contract, it's how I feel. It's part of, you know, the word these days is the phrase is self-care. It's part of my self-care, you know. It's part of my mind and spirit, and it's an artistic thing too. But if you're caught up too much, I think time, just move away from it. Give yourself time, but also to write, but move away from it when you need perspective on your writing. And taking a walk or a nap or sleeping overnight on something is probably the one of the best things you can do to solve a problem.
Thank you. I love that. One of my things for this year is being consistent with my writing practice. And I love that idea of just, it's just part of a self-care practice.
When you
And
show up, yeah, when you show up, things will, the writing is thinking. You don't know what you're thinking until you start putting pen to, and I don't, I would not, when I say writing, I mean daily pen on paper, not typing. I mean, I type every day, but that's thinking. That's like crafting. When I'm free form flowing with ideas and trying to understand what I think about something or what I'm trying to work out or I'm trying to uncover my thinking, then I have journals, you know, and so that is hugely important, and it's part of almost all of my classes. You know, especially the personal essay, because our personal journals give us material for the personal essays.
I was also thinking about that was one thing that I was really working on last year, and I actually think it came out of the course that I did of yours, was this idea of working, because I love free writing. I've always done free writing, but working through your thoughts on something through free writing, but also allowing everything when you start writing it to be a draft, because I've always had this thing, and I'm starting at the age of 41 to finally like get over it of like, everything has to be perfect as soon as I've put it down. Actually, perfect's not even a thing. I don't need to worry about that because it doesn't exist. But like allowing that first or second or third draft, allowing things to be a draft. And I think, well, I know that is absolutely something that I got out of the course that I did with you, because
Yeah.
that was where that it was like a light bulb of like, this can be rubbish.
Yeah. Well, that's what that light bulb moment is really important, because there's different kinds of writing. There's therapeutic writing, there's pre-writing, there's draft. That's all part of the drafting process. There's mind mapping. Then you do a first draft. Then you draft again. Then you draft again. This idea of, you know, it's hard, you know, when I writing something for me, when I pivot from the pre-writing into the writing on the computer. So the pre-writing is all, you know, organizing, getting my voice, thinking about phrases, the angle into a subject, all sorts of things. And then once I've done all of that, I'm like, okay, my thoughts are clarified. Then I turn to my keyboard and I start writing. And even then, I know that the writing is going to go through so many drafts, and that writing is actually rewriting. It's not, and so that's one of the things, you know, I talk a lot about revision, especially at the university level. Revision is, if you break it down, it's seeing again. And that's what I teach people in the classes, is that is you know, getting rid of these shackles of perfectionism. They serve us no purpose in art. It's just not going to work, and it stymies people. In fact, this month, what I'm doing is, for people who sign up for courses, they get a free master class, and it's about this very subject. Because before people come into the classes, which start in February, I want them to begin thinking about how to create an intentional writing practice. And one of them is to let go of perfectionism and to understand which stage of writing that they are in. Therapeutic writing is not memoir writing. It's working things out on your own on a personal level, almost like, you know, trying to, you know, my dad, my mom, my brother, yeah, working the therapy out, and then working the pre-writing, then the draft, you know, drafting. And then by the time it gets to a page, we need to, it's then crafted scenes that represent that writing. But so that is something that's also really important. So I'll be talking about that soon in my upcoming masterclass.
So the last question before we wrap up is casting your mind forward into the future and envisioning kind of what you would like to see. This can be for yourself, or it can be more kind of macro, if you like. What would you like to see? What do you envision when you look forward to kind of best case scenario, I guess?
Yeah. Well, you know, I like to use the word the personal and the universal. And in our writing, we dilate from the personal to the best writing is that dilation. And you see it in Annie Dillard's essay, well, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, why do you think she won the Pulitzer Prize? But in the essay Scene, which I love so much and teach in so many of the classes. But I would say, let's start with the personal and then we can go to the global. Personally, for me, you know, I want to continue teaching, of course. That's also part of my identity in addition to being a writer. But I want to help people fulfill their potential. Either it could be becoming, helping make writing a part of their rituals of being a human. Maybe publication is part of that. Maybe just becoming a better human being. You know, we writers, nature writers in particular, ask the question, how best to live in this world? And I think writing as a reflective process is hugely important to understanding where you want to go universally, you know? So for me, so I want to continue on the trajectory of writing, of honing my voice in particular, writing something that, you know, well, I don't want to talk too much about it at this point, but something new that I think could contribute meaningfully to a particular genre. I think I'm thinking about it right now. So, you know, we don't want to jinx it by talking too much about it. So there's that. So that's the teaching and the writing. In terms of, to answer the universal question, I think I could talk about, a little bit about, you know, a genre of writing called solar punk. And yeah, it's about imagining.
Oh, I love it so much.
yeah. You know, it's the opposite of dystopian environmental, you know, it's imagining green futures. And my hope is that nature writing can help us. Nature writing is that link between those, you know, we've got to have a David Attenborough of nature writing. We've got to have like an Obama of nature writing. We've got Rob Farland, but let's skip some more. But we need to, nature writers are hugely important about helping us imagine the future, you know? And it shouldn't always just be, you know, people with university degrees that talk about it, you know, there's part of the academy. It should be something that trickles down to everybody, you know, and we're seeing that more with, you know, farmers and people who think about the landscape. And, you know, so in my other area of my life, you know, I'm in garden design, you know, I think about, you know, making gardens as sustainable as possible, you know, and sinking carbon into the land, into gardens, and changing how people think of gardens. They're not just, we don't just impose, you know, an English boxwood garden on every landscape, especially like Southern California, you know, just water, you know, a water sink. So designing gardens and helping perhaps write something, a book for Timber Press related to, you know, sustainable and biodiverse garden design. We'll see. I tend to be leaning toward memoir at this point, but we'll see. But yeah, the answer to the universal question is help using cultivating new nature writing so that it helps us imagine the art of what is possible, you know, in our future, and to not feel that everything is so dystopian that there, and also, you know, that despite how dire things are and can seem, that it's okay through writing and art, daily living to find pockets of joy. You know, we get one trip around, you know, one time here, planet Earth is rare and human life is rare. And to enjoy it as well but making the world a better place too.
I love that. I think it's so easy to think that creative practice any kind of creative practice or creative art does nothing, serves, you know, like it's just an indulgence. But I love, yeah, I feel exactly the same about nature writing can be something that changes the world. I fully yeah. believe that.
Well, when I moved here, there was a question. I think we talked about it in my nature writing class, but there was this question, oh, well, you're not a nature writer if you don't address climate change. And I thought, you know what? That's like the critics of Nan Shepherd telling, you know, quietly saying, you know, that's why she kept the Living Mountain in a drawer for 40 years. She was scared of what the reaction would be amongst the male-dominated scientific mountaineering community. And I think, you know, by saying you can only, you're only a nature writer, you can only be a part of our nature writing club if you write about, you know, this. No, there's a whole different range of it, from Annie Dillard's, you know, spiritual and metaphysical, and people writing about social justice issues. You know, there's a whole spectrum. So everyone should feel welcome across the range, whatever you want to do, come in and write, and making art a part of a person's daily life, not a artistic practice that must be, is part of just what you do. You know, it makes you a more thinking, compassionate person, you know?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Catherine. I've loved talking to you so much. I think it's quite rare that you get to speak to, that one gets to speak to their teacher in any kind of great depth. Just before we go, though, can you tell people where they can find you? Just courses coming up or anything in the year that they can, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you again, Helen, for having me. And you asked how people could find me. So I'm at CatherineAlto.com, and I have to spell my name, but I'm sure you have it on the podcast, but
yeah,
K-A-T-H-R-Y-N, and my surname's A-A-L-T-O. So I have, all my courses are starting up in February. I needed January to continue wintering, which I'm enjoying, and working on some I was finishing up some coursework too. So I'm teaching the art of the personal essay, which, don't tell anyone, it's my favorite class. the art of the personal essay, memoir one, memoir two, memoir and life writing one, memoir and life writing two, nature writing, narrative nonfiction one, narrative nonfiction two, and advanced projects. And there's also a taster course that I'm running at the end of January. It's an hour and a half, four nights in a row, just to help people if they want to know what that Catherine Alto is about, and what is creative or narrative nonfiction. That's coming at the end of January. And everything can be found on the course section of my website and on social media. I'm on Instagram and Twitter and at Catherine Alto. So I'd love for people to connect. That'd be great.
Thank you so much. Just again, I'm really grateful for your time and everything that you're doing. Honestly, listening to that list of like classes that you have coming up, I don't know how you do it.
I'm teaching twice a day now. I'm teaching narrative nonfiction one from 4 to 6:30, and then narrative nonfiction two, 7 to 9:30. I've done it so much I could teach it sleeping. Yeah. Kidding. But I just decided that there was so much demand for one and two that I'm just doing them on the same day back to back.
Sure.
So the courses that you hear, duplicates of memoir and life writing one, are on the same days, narrative nonfiction. And they're every other week. They're not every week. So that gives people time and space, and me time and space, to read and write and all that. Yeah. So it's good. I'm looking forward to it.